Science is the great antidote to the poison of enthusiasm and superstition.
So wrote economist Adam Smith in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations, and it's part of the reason why we love science. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
And we watch how their brain changes as that skill becomes learned.
I call it one of the final frontiers in body odor analysis.
All those tiny pores within this charcoal bit, holding water.
You can basically sequence an entire genome in the matter of weeks.
I've worked with other species before, but these mice I'm madly in love
Where
with.
Do you draw the line between what is
the
necessary
last time
to discuss?
Oh my God, it's out!
This is our opportunity. Open your eyes. This is it.
On today's show, experiments, discovery, dedication, disappointment, it's all part of the process we call science. And today we'll listen to some of our favorite moments from The Pulse that speak to the passion it sparks. But first up, the Ebola crisis continues to dominate the news cycle as the death toll rises internationally and new cases are identified in the U.S. Joining us now is New York Times columnist and science writer Carl Zimmer, who was giving a talk in Philadelphia this week on the topic of viruses. Carl, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
I think on the whole, journalists have been careful not to sensationalize, not to catastrophize with Ebola, but it does feel on some level that it seems to be closing in on us. Do you get that sense from readers, from what you're hearing, what people are talking about?
I think that people are very anxious about Ebola. And when you look at surveys, the large majority of Americans are scared that they themselves are going to be at risk of Ebola, which is just not the case. But I think it's just the result of an outbreak happening in an online age. Basically, you can see it on TV and people can trade information on Twitter or on Facebook. And so these things can just keep going and going and going. And it can take on a life of its own.
But then you do read reports where people who are ostensibly trained to deal with something like this, they are now getting sick. It is scary.
We're definitely seeing some weaknesses in our health system. There's no question about that. And we've been hearing from the nurses in the United States complaining about how in this incident in Texas, there really wasn't much of a protocol in place to deal with an Ebola patient. I mean, Ebola was found in 1976, and we have been talking about the potential risk of it for years and years and years. So how could we not have a standard protocol in place? That's really kind of embarrassing.
What are scientists learning about how these viruses come up? We don't hear about Ebola for a long time, then it comes back. What are we learning about how these things happen and come about?
Ebola has a kind of mysterious way of moving around. So we're more familiar with, say, the flu, where it just goes from one person to the next to the next. On the other hand, you have Ebola, which just sort of pops up from time to time and kills a lot of people and then seems to just vanish. But it couldn't just completely vanish, because then how could it come back? So basically, the answer seems to be that it is lurking in animals. And it's not clear which animals are the most important reservoir. Could be bats, certain species of bats. But it's hard to figure out, because even in the species where we know Ebola can live, if you pick out a bat and try to look for viruses inside of it, you may not find any Ebola virus. So it's not yet clear how it's hiding in animals, but clearly it's animals where it's lurking when it's not attacking people.
And how are scientists going about tracking this? I'm thinking that some of the new mapping tools and the ways we can crunch big data now could be really helpful in better tracing this.
Well, we do have a lot of exciting new technology. There's no question about that. We can actually take an animal and take a blood sample and pull out all the DNA in that blood sample, and we can actually find just a handful of copies of viral DNA in there, and say, you know, this animal carries this particular virus. That's pretty amazing, and that's something that previous generations of scientists couldn't do. Scientists can come up with sort of ecological maps that tell you where are the places that have the different kinds of animals that might harbor Ebola? So where would be the places we need to keep an eye on for this kind of reservoir causing outbreaks? The problem is that you actually need people to take that technology and use it.
But do you think they might do that kind of work now? Or is this just on the top of our heads because this is happening as we speak? Will the kind of the urgency fade away?
I hope the urgency doesn't fade away. We tend to focus on, you know, the crisis of the moment and then to forget about it when it's out of view. So, you know, we were all very concerned about bird flu, for example, a few years back, and worried about a global pandemic. Thankfully, we didn't see that happen. But that doesn't mean that the risk has just gone away, because we know that can happen. We know that sometimes bird flus cross over into humans, and we've seen what happens in the past where millions of people die. So we can't take our eye off that ball either. I would hope that, you know, this would really be a wake-up call for long-term investment in understanding how animals and humans trade viruses and to be monitoring this process. You know, the fact that we really have no clue of the true reservoir species of Ebola is kind of ridiculous.
So with Ebola, do you have faith in science then that this thing can be beaten?
The Ebola tends to burn itself out, and the question is how big of a fire is it going to be? A lot of people are going to die along the way. The question of how many people die is really just, it's not really even a science question at this point. It's a question of logistics, of hospital beds and masks and gowns and you know, sort of public health 101. That's all it takes. And, you know, it doesn't take magic to reduce the total number of deaths. And, you know, we came very late to this outbreak, way too late. We should have known that if Ebola shows up in cities that have bad medical care, it was going to be a disaster. And here we are. And now we're going to have to put in a lot more work to slow this thing down. But we should, because the stakes are just too high.
Carl Zimmer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer is an author and New York Times science writer. There are scientists right here in our region who are working to help solve the Ebola crisis. Some are working on an Ebola vaccine. Others are exploring the appropriate quarantine times for the virus. And that brings us to the main theme of today's show, which is why science is so important and why we love it so much. Before he left, I did ask Carl Zimmer one last question, and that is, why does he love science?
When I started writing about science over 20 years ago, I was so fascinated by how I could just every week practically find something new to write about, something that scientists had just discovered that was surprising and changed how I thought about how the world works. And I got worried that maybe after a few years, they would run out. And yet, it's just the opposite has happened, that every day now, I may come across a new study where I just say, I couldn't have possibly predicted that. That is so interesting. As a science writer, you know, I have this great problem, which is there's just way too much good science to write about.
Some of you told us via Twitter why you love science. For example, Becky Urbano wrote that she fell in love with science during biology class when she learned that there was a whole world of action inside every cell. So let's start this chapter of our love letter to science, which we're writing today, and it's kind of already beginning to turn into a book. But this story relates to one of the highest honors a scientist can receive, the Nobel Prize. They were awarded last week, and the Nobel Prize for Physics went to three Japanese researchers for their work on blue light emitting diodes, or LEDs. From the innovations desk, Todd Bookman reports that the foundation for their achievement was laid in none other than New Jersey.
The Nobel Committee's press release says the blue LED will be to the 21st century what the incandescent bulb was to the 20th. It's a more efficient, more sustainable source of light. The judges marveled that the technology was only two decades old.
And I knew for a fact that wasn't the case. I had held an LED that was older than that in my hands.
This is Benjamin Gross, curator of the Sarnoff Collection. It's a small museum dedicated to electronics and broadcasting equipment on the campus of the College of New Jersey. One of the pieces housed here is that old LED. It was made in Princeton, inside the laboratories of RCA.
RCA, in the 1960s, was the leader in consumer electronics in the United States, and one of the things that its chairman, David Sarnoff, really wanted was to create a television that could hang on the wall like a painting.
It's kind of amazing that they were thinking of flat-screen TVs 50 years ago, but to make it a reality, engineers first had to produce three different color diodes.
Red and green ones had been developed in the early 1960s, but blue, for a variety of reasons, turned out to be more complicated.
In 1972, a working prototype finally arrived, apparently unbeknownst to the Nobel people. It's still pretty much in its original form.
It's mounted into a small gray box. How big would you say this is, Jonathan?
I would say that it's about 2.5 by 5 inches.
Jonathan, by the way, is Jonathan Allen. He's a retired physicist who volunteers at the Sarnoff, helping to keep the old equipment up and running.
And the box has a few toggle switches. It looks like there are two toggle switches on the top and one on the side. And there's a little dial here, a power dial adjusts
the current that you put through the light-emitting diode.
So picture this little light bulb connected by two wires to the top of the box. It's technically a compound semiconductor, a material called gallium nitride.
There's a tiny white crystal, and that crystal is the gallium nitride, and that's going to glow, if all goes according to plan, that's going to be the thing that glows blue.
That's right. We're going to see if this 40-year-old device still works. Jonathan hooks up a voltage meter to the antique battery on the underside of the box.
Son of a gun. It actually has some poop.
How much voltage are we
talking about? We've got 20 volts.
That's not bad.
Having poop is apparently engineering speak for power. I didn't ask.
I think we're ready if we want to try getting started. We can call Herb Maruska and see if we can get this LED lit.
Maruska, this is the guy who was working at RCA in the early 1970s and actually built this thing, the first working blue LED. He's still around, retired and living in Florida. Over a speakerphone, he urges the team to be cautious.
Yeah, there's only one, so you gotta be careful.
There's only one, right, so double check the connections and turn it up very slowly.
Yeah, black to black, red to red. Yep. All right, here we go. Anything?
Not yet, no.
Let's recheck the plugs.
It isn't the plugs. Turns out it's the lack of poop in the old battery. They reroute to another power source, turn the dial, and...
Yes, we're drawing current. We are drawing current. We've got a couple of milliamps here.
We got it.
It's lighting faintly.
We've got blue. It's glowing.
It's glowing
blue.
That
is definitely blue. Yep. That is beautiful.
Yep, we've got 3 milliamps.
That is amazing.
You want me to give any more poop? You want me to give it?
No, don't over poop it.
These guys are over the moon. This little blue light, this artifact from the tail end of the golden age of American technology, still fires. Maruska told me that just as he completed this work in the early 1970s, RCA's empire began to crumble. His entire department was scrapped. Some Japanese researchers picked up the project, and by the early 90s, they had built stable, efficient blue LEDs, the lighting that is changing the way we see. It's that accomplishment that earns the Nobel Prize. But Benjamin Gross hopes the whole story, this American story, gets told.
And it all starts here. It all starts in New Jersey, in the Delaware Valley, at RCA.
For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You have to see the pictures of the first blue LED in action. We got them on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And coming up on the show, our love letter to science gets longer and longer with fun experiments, puzzling questions, and jelly beans. Yes, jelly beans. They are part of the scientific process.
Coffee, and here we've got banana. Basically, what we do is we take two jelly beans that are two different flavors, then put them in your hand, randomly move them around so you don't know which is which.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Science like Galileo, drop the orange.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our theme today is Why We Love Science. We're going to listen back to bits and pieces from some of our favorite reports now. Science often offers us a deeper understanding of processes that we take for granted, like hearing a word and knowing what it means.
Hot.
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 It's hot.
Not too hot.
So saying the word hot sends sound waves to your eardrum, but how do we extract meaning from that? Penn Medicine researcher Maria Geffen is fascinated by that question and tries to untangle sound and meaning in her experiments. Reporter Tanya English met up with Geffen. Let's listen to a part of her story.
In her lab, Geffen also works with nature sounds. We hear this. And she says, we all think water. And more precisely, we think gurgling brook.
We know mathematically what is it within the sound waveform that makes it sound like the brook or not.
Next, Geffen plays with that knowledge. She takes the same recording of the babbling brook, but this time strips out the signal that makes the brain think water.
That doesn't really sound like anything. Maybe static noise on the TV.
The scientists also add that particular sound property that Geffen has isolated to create a completely man-made sound.
You can make my brain think that I'm listening to gurgling water.
That's right. That made all the difference in you hearing this as an artificial sound or a gurgling water brook. And what we'll find is, yes, a bunch of neurons are sensitive to those water sounds. But that's not gonna tell us how is it that that sensitivity comes about.
Geffen and her team are just beginning to crack that code. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Researcher Maria Geffen says understanding the process of hearing and assigning meaning could eventually lead to better hearing aids and cochlear implants. We're listening back to some of our favorite science moments on The Pulse today, and sometimes a simple experiment can shed light on an important connection that we've taken for granted or perhaps never even thought about. Here's reporter Tanya English again. This time, she's observing an experiment at Philadelphia's Monell Chemical Senses Center with director Gary Beecham. It illustrates the strong connection between our sense of smell and taste.
To demonstrate, Beecham pours out a cup of jelly beans. For this experiment, the gourmet kind are best.
Coffee.
Licorice, watermelon.
And here we've got banana.
Without looking, he chooses two candies.
Basically, what we do is we take two jelly beans that are two different flavors, then put them in your hand, randomly move them around so you don't know which is which. You hold your nose very tightly. So then take one of the jelly beans, put it in your mouth, chew it up.
Then Beecham takes a guess.
The only thing I get in terms of flavor is sweet. So then all I have to do is let go of my nose, and boom, there it is.
Licorice. On its own, the tongue perceives salty or bitter or sour, but without smell, the subtleties of anise or fennel are missing. When people go to the doctor complaining about smell loss, though, they don't get much sympathy.
Their primary physician often has no idea what to say or what to do. They consider it sort of like losing a toenail or something like that.
Researchers at Monell and Jefferson are doing stem cell research to see if they could restore function in people who've lost their sense of smell.
By the way, reporter Tanya English says she fell in love with science when her teacher demonstrated thermal expansion, surface tension, and the Maillard reaction by baking a cake. Yes. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today we're playing some of our favorite science moments from the show. How could you not love science? Good question, but it can be hard to understand, and that's often a turnoff for people who recall torturous physics lessons in high school or snoozefest lectures they attended, but don't blame science, you just have to explain it right. This piece by Alana Gordon takes the complicated science behind Narcan, the overdose antidote we've been hearing so much about, and makes it click.
This is Narcan, two doses of Narcan that I carry in my patrol vehicle.
The drug is called naloxone, and it is technically referred to as an opioid antagonist.
That is Tom Ferraro.
I'm a professor of biomedical sciences at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University.
In Camden. And?
Officer Maureen Bainey from the Camden County Police Department.
She works patrol, 3rd District.
It's an orange box.
So it blocks the ability of opioids to do what they do at the molecular level.
Ferraro says, think of the receptors in your brain as having locks on them. Think of opioids as very special keys. When they get in your system, they seek out those locks on the receptors.
So normally the morphine or the heroin latches on and it's able to unlock the lock.
And it opens and closes that lock again and again.
And then that triggers a cascade of biochemistry inside that particular cell.
This is the basic mechanism of being high. The heroin repeatedly unlocks the lock, releasing from that cell euphoria, happiness, pain relief. But it also tells your body to slow down. Take too much of an opioid? Those keys flood the locks in your brain, and so your breathing and heart rate,
they slow down too slow.
And there you have an overdose.
His lips were blue, his fingertips were blue, he was sweating profusely.
Enter Narcan. Think of it as a key scientists cut to specially fit those locks that heroin likes. But when it gets in those locks, it acts differently.
It's able to, just like morphine, bind, but it doesn't unlock. So it attaches, but it's not able to trigger the cascade of effects inside the cell.
It just sits there, blocking the opioid's access to the lock.
And so you outcompete the morphine.
It all happens very, very quickly.
It's like a countdown.
Almost instantaneously.
The ones that I witnessed, less than 30 seconds it works.
And so if the Narcan's administered soon enough, that slow heart rate, even unconsciousness,
the effects are reversed.
Literally, he's like, watch, it's going to be like a mummy. And they were dead, weren't breathing. They administered and they sat straight up and they asked where they were.
It's phenomenal. It truly is an antidote.
Reporter Alana Gordon speaking with Rowan University biomedical science professor Tom Ferraro and Officer Maureen Bainey from the Camden County Police Department. Of course, science isn't always so serious. A lot of it is fun, whimsical, more to love. Some scientists study flamingos. They do, and it's not frivolous, it's important stuff. Matthew Anderson, a professor of psychology at St. Joseph's University, researches Caribbean flamingo behavior at the Philadelphia Zoo, and he finds keys to human behavior.
Flamingos are big, they're beautiful, they're iconic. It's tough not to like them. I study animals to learn about behavior in general. Psychology is the science of behavior and mental processes. And so much as all animals have behavior and mental processes, they're relevant. Flamingos are highly social animals. If I had to guess what they were thinking about, I'd guess that they would probably think about the behaviors of their fellow flock members. The Philadelphia Zoo has a nice, decent-sized flock of 17, and they've been very receptive and supportive of our research. You go and you watch the animals and you get interested in what they're doing and try to figure out why they're doing it. almost every aspect of their behavior is social in nature. When one of them gets aroused, they all get aroused. They're so highly in tune and so highly social in nature that some captive flocks and zoos, to get them to mate, you actually have to stick mirrors in their exhibits to fool them essentially into thinking there's a large enough flock there. I originally was interested in resting behaviors because if you go to the zoo during the middle of the day when most people tend to go to the zoo, flamingos are going to be resting. And so that's sort of where we started. Why do they stand on one leg? Well, we've shown that it definitely serves a thermoregulatory function. More resting flamingos tend to be on one leg when it's cooler out. And also when they're resting in the water versus on land, they tend to be on one leg more often. Water would pull away more body heat than air would. When they're standing in there, they want to essentially keep a little warmer. I think it probably has multiple functions, but that's definitely one of them, our research has suggested. Another aspect of their resting behavior that becomes obvious when you watch them is that they place their heads like on their back when they're resting, and this forces them to curve their necks to either their right or their left. We were curious to see if there's a side preference in this behavior. At least in the Caribbean flamingo, most of them tend to prefer to right. The big question that's still out there is, why do most animals have a lateral preference? Why are most people right-handed? It's not always the case, but when we see these population-level lateral preferences, why do they exist? And if you really think about it, they probably shouldn't. I mean, there should be a lot of pressures against such a thing. If our behaviors are predictable, it should make us easier to eat and easier to avoid if we're trying to catch you. That's one of the questions that we were trying to ask with the flamingos is, A, do they have these lateral preferences? And you know, B, what might they mean? If we can understand why other animals have these tendencies, it might give us some clue as to why we do.
Flamingo, like a flame in the sky.
These are fun studies to do, going to the zoo and watching giant pink birds. That's fun. And also very interesting.
Flamingo.
Matthew Anderson is a professor of psychology at St. Joseph's University. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. We at The Pulse occasionally like to study scientists outside of their usual habitat, in a radio studio. We bring them in for a segment called So What Do You Do?, where we observe the scientists interacting with a species that's unfamiliar to them, called lay people. And sometimes they throw a big unscientific curveball. That's what happened when evolutionary biologist and geneticist Rob Kolathanol of Temple University spoke with New Jersey writer Matt Skoufalos.
As a kid, I read a lot of comic books, and there were people who had crazy superpowers like growing wings or shooting laser beams, something like that. Is it possible evolutionarily for us to get to that place?
For something like that, for wings to arise, you must have many years, you must have a lot of time, and you must have a constant selective pressure that basically allows variation that's found in a population to be molded into an individual with wings.
So it wouldn't be until we became like an arboreal, cliff-dwelling kind of species that we would need to grow wings?
Well, perhaps one day, if there was variation in a population, and if some individuals had small little wings in the back of their back, maybe one day we could actually select for those over many, many, many generations.
All right, an easier one. What about prehensile tails or picking things up with our feet, thumbs on our hand? Come on, help me out here. When do we get to be cooler?
We are cool. And that's actually kind of the coolest thing about evolution. We are species that are at around 7 billion individuals right now. There is a lot of room for mutational processes to take place. You know, years ago when our species was at, you know, 100,000, mutation had to accumulate over a long time. Now with 7 billion people, mutations take place that much faster.
Well done, Rob Kolathanol, answering Matt Skoufalos' questions during our So What Do You Do? Segment. Coming up on The Pulse, our love letter to science turns into a love song.
As long as I'm good and warmed up, I can sing anything in my range, including falsetto.
Science and Broadway, still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright.
In
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is all about our massive crush on science and why we love it so. Scientists and researchers often find ways for all of us to do our jobs better, even Broadway singers like Jared Spector, because singing is a tough job.
It's a relentless, never-ending task to take care of your body so that you can hit those notes day after day after day, because if you do anything the night before, going out and drinking, screaming, if you get sick, anything that takes away, say, the top 10% of your range, well, you're out. That's it. You can't sing it. You have to be in the utmost health at all times to be able to sing a role of, you know, that difficulty.
Reporter Christopher Intagliata investigated the research that allows Broadway stars to perform night after night after night without injuring their vocal cords. That's how he met Brian Gill. He is director of vocal pedagogy in music and performing arts professions in the Steinhardt School at New York University. Gill gave Intagliata a little lesson in physics.
So the vocal folds are down in the larynx, in the neck. So the airflow coming up from the lungs makes them vibrate. But if there's too much resistance there, the tissue will have increased friction, and friction's the enemy of that tissue.
Think of how friction causes calluses on your hands or feet. The same can happen to your vocal folds. You want to minimize that friction.
So you do things like that are called in Nerdville semi-occluded vocal tract postures. So one of the most popular is the lip trill. And when you go and you have this buzz going at your lips, you've actually created a resistance at your lips, which reduces the amount of pressure that falls across the vocal folds. So you kind of get the instrument going, you get the muscles coordinated, you become more aware of the resonance, and you become more aware of the breath energy. If they're pressing on their voice, that'd be bad. And then they get used to the flowy feeling that is more efficient, and then they try and reproduce that in the show.
But aside from that flowy feeling, there's another trick performers can use to belt louder without hurting themselves: singing the right vowel sounds in songs.
The vocal tract, the way it's shaped, has a certain pitch or pitches at which it resonates best. I'll give you an example of E-A-A-O-U.
He's flicking his throat as he mouths those vowel sounds.
When I shape those vowels, there's a particular pitch in there, and those pitches line up with the information that's coming from the vocal folds themselves. And when they interact positively, you can get a really good boost of sound. You can also get like a really belty sound if you hit the right resonance of the vocal tract with the right harmonic from the vocal folds. But in actuality, you're not working that hard.
Frankie Valli used that trick to his advantage, as did Jared Spector, the guy who was warming up at the beginning of the piece when he played Valli in Jersey Boys.
There's a song, Working My Way Back to You, in Jersey Boys. And if you try to sing, Working My Way Back to You, first of all, it doesn't sound right. It's completely out of the style. But, you know, also I was like, how did Frankie sing it? And he doesn't say way, he says way. So it's Working My Way Back to You, babe.
Working my way back to you, babe.
And you hear the word way because you know what it is, but it's so much easier to sing and so much easier to sing that high note.
Brian Gill, the voice coach, says you can also hear that vowel change in the tune Astonishing from Little Women.
At the end, the character sings Astonishing, but they actually never sing Astonishing, because if they did, it would tune in a way that would sound too disconnected. So they all sing Astonishing. And it's wide open, so they can get a belty sound. If you live in a society where in music theater everybody's supposed to be able to do legit and belt and all these things and sort of gospel-y screams, and then finding what you can do sustainably is the key to a really long career.
As is taking good care of your instrument, the voice. Here's Jared again.
I find that a lot of my castmates are always like, wow, you're so diligent with your voice. It's like, yeah, because I want to sing tomorrow. You know, when I go out on stage, I don't hold back. I sing full out every single night. Girl, there's a better
life for me and you. For The Pulse, I'm Christopher Intagliata.
Sticking with the topic of voice for a moment, one of our favorite science interviews on the show involved a new study on vocal fry. And for this, regular Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire explained what vocal fry is.
Okay, so vocal fry is actually a real thing. It is it's the lowest vocal register. So you need to lower your voice to the very lowest that it can go.
Okay.
And then you need to relax your vocal cords. So it goes down and you have relaxed vocal cords, so air comes through. So at the very end, it sounds kind of like you're running out of oxygen.
So you're talking like this, then you let your voice drop, and then how do you relax your vocal cords?
You're kind of getting there. Basically, you're allowing air to bubble through the compressed but relaxed vocal cords, creating an irregular vibration, and that's what causes the creakiness of the vocal fry.
All right. But it just felt like somebody punched me in the throat when I was doing that.
I don't think it's supposed to hurt.
No, but it's not good for our voice, right?
There's actually not a lot of studies on whether or not vocal fry is good for you or not. I'm very curious, actually, to find out if it has a negative effect on, you know, vocal health, if it's good long term.
Bethany Brookshire is also known as PsyCurious. She is a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and today's show is all about why science is amazing. Amazing like finding a gigantic dinosaur 7 times bigger than a T-Rex. That's precisely what Drexel University paleontologist Ken Lacovera did. He led the team that discovered Dreadnoughtus. In this report by Carolyn Beeler, he describes how he found the first piece of bone at a remote field site in southern Patagonia, 100 miles off the power grid and originally reachable only by rafting down a glacial stream.
I was sitting on a barren sandstone hill. We have the Andes Mountains in sight. You can see the snow-capped peaks. Every day you see giant Andean condors with a 9-foot wingspan.
Lacovera said in this epic setting, the moments following his discovery were pure magic.
This individual hasn't seen the light of day, in this case in 77 million years. And then when you find a new species for a little bit, you're the only human that has ever known this. And so I remember sitting there that night kind of by myself and looking at this new dinosaur, wondering, who are you? What did you do for a living? What was it like then? And all these questions, and you start to imagine its environment, and it's the thing that keeps us all doing this.
Drexel paleontologist Ken Lacovera on the discovery of the Dreadnoughtus. He spoke with Carolyn Beeler, who is known to travel to some remote places herself in pursuit of great science stories, trekking through sewage waters, muddy marshes, salty fields, and most recently climbing into a stormwater reservoir. And here's what that sounded like.
I'm going to yell. Just ignore me. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Underneath Venice Island, in Mania.
Science happens in strange places. We know that, even at the circus. Reporter Alana Gordon met David Borneo at a Franklin Institute circus event. Borneo is better known as the human blockhead.
So I shove sharp implements directly into the center of my skull.
Like a 6-inch stainless steel roofing nail up his nose.
I would say it's not comfortable, but not painful.
There's a problem. I hit a stud.
Abby Cockstein and Jerome the Cloud had been in the front row laughing and at times cringing.
My biggest question is how he put that nail up his nose and where it went. I don't understand.
Yeah, I want to know what was missing in his head for the nail to go that deep.
Outside at one of the demo tables, Evan Goldman, a professor of anatomy at Rowan University, uses his own props to break down the science. He says Fornia's nail stunt is not as bad as you think.
The problem is, if you don't aim it in the right direction, there are two areas where you can really cause damage. Number one is you've got, in your nasal passages, you have these things which are called nasal concha.
He picks up a skull and points inside the nasal passage to some barely visible, extremely delicate curved slivers of bone protruding from both sides toward the middle. They're normally lined with a mucous membrane.
So if you hit those, then you're going to get a lot of pain. You're going to get blood gushing all over the place.
Goldman then picks up a metal probe. Imagine it's Bornea's nail. And demonstrates on the skull how very carefully it can slide through the nasal passage a few inches back.
At that point, if I flip the skull up, you will see I'm actually essentially in the back of the mouth.
That's because the back of the nasal cavity and the back of the oral cavity of the mouth are connected in an area called the pharynx. Go too far beyond that and you could start bleeding. Or worse.
You're very, very close to the vertebral column. And so if you jam a nail into your nose and take it with a hammer, you could hit the vertebra, and those vertebra are thin there, and you could go right into your spinal cord.
Not good. So how does Bornea do it?
He knows exactly how far to go. And he's a good showman.
Alana Gordon reporting.
Science is real, from the Big Bang to DNA. Two scientists are racing for the good.
Science. On blind faith, they place reliance. What we need more of is science. On blind faith, they place reliance. What we need more of is science.
And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Gray Tennis is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always, always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.